welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, and welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of Syosset Public Library. I'm your host, Jen, and today we are speaking with two very exciting guests. Could I ask you to introduce yourselves?
Hi, yeah, I'm Jackson Lansing.
Hi, and I am Colin Kelly.
And together we are the Lansing Kelly Hive Mind, behind a lot of comic books on your local comic book shelves.
Yeah, you guys have a really interesting career together, as well as separately. Like, you've done a lot of really interesting and varied projects. So I'd like to start, if we can, with how you met and how you started working together creatively. And how did you come to this partnership?
So we both went to the University of Southern California for college, and Colin had grown up in Hawaii and Seattle. I had grown up in Santa Cruz, California, and then in Boston. And we both come from sort of very different backgrounds, but very similar families in some ways. We were both children of divorce. We both had like single hippie moms. And we found ourselves at college at the same film school. Colin was in the screenwriting program. I was in the directing program. And on paper, that really seems like we would be fast friends. There's an easy collaboration move. There's all the stuff. And obviously we have a lot in common. I ended up becoming very good friends with Colin's very good friend, David Server. And the jealousy between the two of us over our mutual friendship with David became an initial pain point for us. So for the first, like, say, year of our relationship, we were effectively nemeses. Who were trying to like outcool the other guy and like be the cool dude of the two dudes. I think we were just like peacocking for our buddy David's attention. And
eventually we ended up in a writing group together, effectively trying to like, you know, finally bring the final conflict as we proved who was truly the better creator. And unfortunately what that led to was me reading Jackson's work and realizing the kind of heart and empathy and character at the heart of it.
And I was reading Colin's work and realizing that you could tell these like giant scopey $400 million like genre films, like these things that I would never have in a million years thought you could write.
Yeah. So that kind of built a mutual creative respect between us. And then after graduation, we started kind of accidentally collaborating, basically just telling stories with each other, because we'd spent, you know, the next 4 years getting our comic books every Wednesday and discussing stories and discussing the nature of story and storytelling and kind of honing a similar perspective on a lot of this stuff. So then we kind of organically started working together, telling these stories, and realized that telling stories together was just way more fun and far more creatively rewarding than working alone.
And so after school, we ended up going out onto a road trip. That was like, I think the big pivotal moment for us was we went on this road trip. On the way out, we were going to a music festival in Chicago. And on the way out, it was like, this was before podcasts or anything like that. So on the way out, we had to figure out something to do with our time. And because we're both storytellers, we ended up just kind of talking about movies and eventually breaking a movie. And then on the way back, and literally like writing it out, longhand. And then on the way back, we had one computer between the two of us, and we got ahead of schedule on our way back. And so we stopped at a small hotel outside Yellowstone and just worked on this script all day. We just took one day to just, I don't know, let's see what happens if we like co-write a script. And we ended up getting like 80 pages done in that one day. We were like, what is that? Like, this is wild. Like, there's like a spark here that is kind of insane. And is more, there's sort of more productivity and quality out of both of our work than there would be as individuals. And so we came back from that road trip with our first screenplay, basically. Like, we did a couple of months of revision on it and then sent it to an agent who had hit pocketed Colin, and that got our career started. I mean, we started taking meetings and going around LA and doing the screenwriter hustle. We sold a couple of things and did our kind of early 20s Hollywood dance, starting off of that. And because we started our career together, it kind of never made sense for us to then like go and split off and do individual stuff. Like we have individual lives and occasionally we'll do individual writing, but by and large, we found that the real sort of the emotional and the actual like physical pager is a lot greater together. Mm. And so we built that out. And then when comics came calling, when we, cause we were over in screen and television, which is a really tough place to be when in your early to mid 20s, when you're not say like a staffer, and even there it's really tough, but we were out there, you know, being asked to like sell $300 million movies, which was effectively impossible for us to do. Like it just was not going to happen, but we were out there doing it. It got really frustrating because you get to a point where you're like, no matter whether or not there's two of you and you can back each other up and all of that, nothing's getting made. And that's really tough for a writer because you're writing into a vacuum and people, you know, you go to a, you're hanging out with somebody new and they say, what do you do? And you're like, oh, I'm a writer. And they're like, anything I would have read? And you're sort of like, no, it's all gone into a vault on some production company shelf somewhere in Los Angeles. No one ever gets to see it again. Like, boo. And that was not super fun. So David Server, our mutual friend who introduced us, he and I had made a comic called Freak Show that had sort of gotten me a little bit of a connection in the comic space. And Dave didn't really want to continue as a writer. He became a manager and manages a lot of like larger level talent now. But I wanted to go write. And so when the next comic opportunity came our way, which was a book called Hacktivist at Archaea for Alyssa Milano, they came to us and said, you know, hey, would you be interested in coming on board this? And I said, well, yeah, but can it be Colin and I? Because we've been doing a lot of projects together. I think it'd be fun. And when we got hired on that job, that was our first, you know, book together. And we had such a great time of it and really learned how to do it that it became it sort of snowballed from there. And we've been a partnership ever since.
Well, and to speak to the point of getting something actually made, at first it was an interesting new exploration in the medium, but then the fact that you write something, it gets drawn and then it gets released was a heady, addicting drug that, you know, you can't really get over. Once you start having people actually be able to read and watch and care about the work you are doing, it's very hard to turn away from that. So, and plus, because we had that DNA of falling in love and talking about comics, it was a really natural fit. And once we started doing it, we kind of never stopped.
That's really cool. And it speaks to something that I've often been interested in as an idea that, and it's, you know, by no means a new idea, but that comics is not just a medium, but it's also a community, you know, and it brings people together and it fosters creativity and all these connections and stuff like that. And that's super interesting to me.
It absolutely is. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's the thing that is really so is Hollywood. Like ultimately they're, but it is a different kind of community that functions on really different goals and it's fractured in a different way. Comics is a lot smaller. And the big thing that comics has that other industries don't is that the gatekeepers are a lot more accessible and there are a lot less of them. So when you are trying to get something made, your barrier to entry in comics is a lot lower than your barrier to entry in film and television, where often it is about who you know or who has money or who your family is. That stuff matters a lot more in film and television than it does in comics. So when you're coming from nothing, like Colin and I both were, where we were not coming from Hollywood families, we had no connection to this industry, like we were, you know, new effectively. We were able to come into comics and be able to operate on, I'm not going to say that it's a level playing field because nothing is. We are two straight white dudes. Like that's going to always put us at an advantage and I can't ignore that. But as far as the larger, you know, ecosystem was concerned, our barrier to entry in Hollywood and television, you know, in film and television was a lot higher than our barrier to entry in comic books. And that let comics and graphic novels, which was a mutual passion of ours, really become a place for us to hone our craft, become stronger what we do and figure out what kind of stories were great for us to tell. So it's one of the things I love about comics is then you get to know everybody within that within that industry and you have all of your peers and those people are coming up at the same time as you are. And so we've gotten to watch as a whole bunch of incredible writers and artists have made their way from people that, you know, nobody had heard of and, you know, were just like our friends at bars to now, you know, being these huge deals, running large scale IP and, you know, writing these huge characters. It's a real trip.
Yeah, it's really cool to me. And I don't know if it's unique to comics or you find it elsewhere, but I've found that in comics, you have a lot of interesting overlap between like colleague relationships, but that are also sort of like fan relationships too, right? Like you can be colleagues and even coworkers sometimes, but you can also be fans of each other and just like the different layers of connection that kind of exist in these spaces.
There's in any creative field, there's going to be, you know, hurt feelings. There's going to be people who get the job that you want. But by and large, I think because comics is so small, there's a real no jerks policy. And if you are a jerk, you will get that reputation. Now, sometimes the talent is too much to ignore and you can get away with being a jerk like in any industry. But exactly because it is smaller, because it is this community, it's really easy to be excited for other people. You know, and especially when there are these people who we came up with now getting these really cool jobs, or just, I mean, really anybody. It's a great story. Yeah. If it's your first book, it's a great story. If you're 50th, as long as you continue doing cool work, it's just, it's really exciting to be able to be a fan. Because that's what we are. First and foremost, we are fans of this. It just so happens that occasionally we get paid.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about this sort of like transition or like this, the fact that you have worked in screenwriting as well as comics writing. I'm really interested in the relationship between the two. Did you find that your experience as screenwriters inflected your approach to comics? And then also vice versa, do you think that writing comics then changed your approach to screenwriting?
So 1,000%, but I think it's really interesting because there are fundamental distinctions in the medium that you cannot really ignore and that you have to adapt to as you work in both mediums. And in fact, sometimes working a lot in one medium can detract from your ability to work properly in the other medium. So when we do a lot of comics all at once, and then we have to pivot over to a screenplay, there is always a small period of adjustment because, for instance, and again, this can get very in the weeds, so I'll try to stay at a pretty high level, but like on a baseline level, the distinction between comics and screenplays is that in a screenplay, you are making room for the director. A big part of writing a screenplay is that you are creating the objective of the document, of the script, is it is a communication tool to producers, directors, and actors primarily at first, that is designed to inspire them as to what the movie can be. It's designed to basically have just enough information to get everyone on page about what this thing is, to take them through the story and make them feel like they watched the movie, right? Even though they have not. And that means leaving room for what the camera's doing, leaving room for what the soundtrack is doing, leaving room for actor choice. And not really filling in all those gaps, not being as specific as you might be if, say, you were directing the movie. On the flip side, in comics, you have one person, really, that your script is directed at, which is the artist. Mm. The artist is the entire objective for the script. Yes, you're getting it through an editor first in like corporate comics, so Marvel or DC or somebody, you know, Valiant, they will read your script and will give you notes and go through that whole process with you, but they aren't the actual intended target. The intended target of the script is your artist. Mm. So when you're doing that, the script can be a lot more informal. It can be a lot more like, hey, here's what we're thinking about. You can do whatever you want. Here's some ideas. But then you got to put up those ideas. So you are giving that to the artist, but then you're effectively directing the artist. I think there's a thing Dave and I used to use as like a framework, which is like the artist is kind of the director cinematographer. The editor is kind of the director producer. And then the writer is the writer director. And everyone's a director in their own way in comics, but especially the higher up you get as a writer and the more you're working in corporate comics, the more you are expected effectively to be the director. You're expected to come in and be able to say, okay, here's what's on the page. Here's how it's presented. Here's how it's designed to make me feel. Here's the page layout. Like some artists don't want you to do that. And that's great. Like we love working with artists who have their own sort of objectives and each script ends up being kind of bespoke to each artist. But you're really just, you're getting very specific and really pitching a lot of ideas and getting the artist on page, as opposed to a screenplay where you're kind of trying to get out of a lot of that specificity and instead stay on a high level and involve people emotionally and pull them along the story and inspire them about the way they might execute on that scene or that shot or that score or whatever. So the actual objectives being different means that sometimes when we come back from screenplays or come back to screenplays from comics, we might overwrite. Right? We might sit there and add too much direction. There might be too much stage direction. There might be too much specificity because what you want is not to have a screenplay that tells you exactly how the movie is shot. You want to have a screenplay that inspires a director to shoot that movie in a great way. Mm. That's sort of our, to me, that's the distinction, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super interesting. And that makes a ton of sense to me. You know, and I've even been really thinking a lot about how even writing different comics sort of requires different rhythms and stuff like that. Like mm-hmm. in the past, so I've co-authored a webcomic and then I co-authored a graphic novel with Sophie Goldstein. And writing a webcomic is a totally different rhythm than writing a graphic novel was. Like the beats land in different pages and you have to think about like page turns and you have to think about like all these different sort of like the shape of the comic, and, you know. So it is super interesting to me the way that like different kinds of writing can have these differences and then these other, you know, similarities. So
it also, I think it also pivots from tone to tone. That's a place where, you know, Colin and I work in several different, I think, tones in terms of our work. I think that's one of the benefits of a partnership to some degree is that we aren't easily pigeonholed from like a writing perspective. We can write something as sort of punk rock and free and joyful as like Joyride, and then we can turn around and write something very abstract and a little bit more, for lack of a better term, like poetic. In something like Zojicon. And then we can find, and then, you know, we might be rolling in to write something that feels very real and very grounded and very character oriented, like Hacktivist. And all three of those tones live in our work. And we kind of pivot between those tones and figure out what those do. And then those tones demonstrate a different layout. They demonstrate a different amount of dialogue on the page. Each book is going to demand that we pull out a different skill set to make that book the best story it can be for what kind of story it's gonna be, rather than rolling into each story. And this is, I think, genuinely just true of us as a partnership and probably isn't as true for individual writers as much. I'm sure it changes from writer to writer, but we don't really come into the project and say, well, cool, this is how we do it. We do our the way we write, so that's how we're gonna write. Instead, it's much more, okay, step in and we have to have an initial conversation about what kind of writer are we on this project?
Mm.
You know, like we literally have to calibrate the brain externally before mm-hmm. we execute the thing internally.
That's a great transition for me because I want to start to talk about your books that are coming up. And I'm wondering, is there a difference to your approach when you are writing something that's an original creation and when you are writing something that is somebody else's IP?
100%. There's a lot of different tools that are used. Obviously, when you're working with an IP, you have to be building off of a legacy of the character. You know, you have to approach it with the respect that it deserves. You need to look at where it's been so that you can kind of track a course forward that is going to be interesting and innovative and engaging, because you can't really, you know, there's no point in playing the hits. That's occasionally something that, you know, it's very, let me back up, I guess, a second. One of the things about licensed books is we realized early on, here, everyone, lean close for a secret. It's all just fan fiction. All you're doing is taking the thing that you love and then saying, wouldn't it be wild if blank meets blank? And the answer is yes. The first book we did of, you know, big two books was a book called Batman and Robin Eternal. And on our very first issue, we had Tim Drake and Jason Todd jumping through a window, and the window shatters in the shape of a bat. And then they fight Bane, because literally, why not?
Yes.
And we were like, can we do this? And our editor looked at us and was like, yeah, guys. You write the coolest thing possible at all times. This is literally the job. It was a wild moment of realization. However, it's also really easy then to just kind of, as I said, play the hits. You can do the thing that is very cool and is very easy because you know it's a crowd pleaser. You know they always want to see that, so it's an easy shorthand to deploy. The tricky thing then is taking what everyone knows and then innovating and turning it into something new that feels familiar, but which is actually something they've never seen. I mean, that is incredibly important for Big Two Comics because, you know, otherwise you're just rehashing the past. And one of those things, perhaps you might say that some of our books might be more successful if we just wanted to rehash the past, but we don't. That's boring. That's creatively dull. That's creatively, you know, inert. So we always do feel like a need to push it. And that does come from our creator-owned work, from the stuff that we have, the free rein to really just follow our hearts and follow our instincts and tell the stories in a way that we want to, you know. And because of that, when we do bring our energy to Big Two Comics, you know, I think I heard earlier that you're a fan of Kang. You know, there's a way to do these books that is very expected, but that's boring. So really got to bring that creator-owned perspective to everything you do, which is to tell the best story possible and also utilize the characters in a way that is always real and authentic.
So I think that's to some degree that is the real, I think, distinction and the marker between writing our Big Two books or like a licensed book and writing a creator-owned. It is not enough to play the hits, for sure, though it's great to be aware of them. But something that I think we've learned, because I do not think that we've had a straight line, or I don't think it's been a straight horizontal line of quality since we entered Big Two Comics. I think we got into Big Two Comics and we learned, and we've gone on a steady increase, I would hope, of getting better at this and for people to kind of see what we can do there. Because when you do start off, there is a real part of you that wants to just stay safe. It's like, if you're writing Batman, get the Joker in there quickly so that people know you're doing the thing that is safe and expected and understandable, even if you're doing it in an exciting new way. At least get in there and do the thing. But something that we learned in large part from people like James Tynan, who were big, you know, proponents of us when we started, you know, he was our first boss at DC. You know, we worked on Batman and Robin Eternal with James. He was our showrunner on that book. And he was a friend of ours before that. I mean, we worked together at Boom Studios when he was doing The Woods and we were doing Joyride. And I always really thought he had a great, you know, framework for this, which is, yes, come in and use some of the stuff that people know, because they need to, they you know, people are picking up Batman to get Batman, so they want to get some Batman, so make sure there's some Batman in your Batman, right? But at the same time, it's really important to add new toys to the toy box. And that's a financial decision, obviously, because you get royalties and all that kind of stuff, which is great. But it's also very much a creative decision, which is, it makes it start to feel more like a creator out for you. You get to step in and say, oh, I'm bringing in this guy and this guy and this guy. So if you look at say, James's Batman run, he's bringing in Clown Hunter and he's bringing in Widowmaker, Orphan Maker? Ghostmaker. He's bringing in Ghostmaker. He's bringing in Punchline. He's bringing in these characters who are his, who, yes, are based on other frameworks. They're based on like a Ra's al Ghul framework, or they're based on a Joker framework, or they're based on a whatever. But they're a great new opportunity to come in and try to do your own thing inside the context of the thing as it exists. And so as we've gone into 2022 and in kind of a new era for us of Big Two Comics, where we are not playing second fiddle or kind of like doing a like side gig, we're taking over large characters and trying to really like live where they are and trying to, you know, live up to these runs that inspired us. We are adding a lot of new toys to the pot. Batman Beyond is mostly new characters. Our Captain America run is mostly new characters. Our run that we're just completing right now on Harbinger, it's mostly new characters. When we came in on Star Trek was very much an objective of trying to take about half new stuff, maybe two-thirds new stuff, and then take one-third stuff that we felt was left on the floor that could be really interesting and try to develop that out and do new stuff with it. We by the time that we were done with the Tholians and with Gary Seven, they very much felt like our creations, even though obviously they were not. I think those are, that's what we try to get to now in all of our work, is try to find a way to make it, even when it's a legacy character. I think if we come in and just play with the toys that are on the table, some writers are excellent at that, at not bringing necessarily new creations in, but rather really playing those characters as they live. I don't necessarily think we're those guys. I think we have a real benefit in bringing new characters, new frameworks, and new kinds of stories to the table. And those aren't always going to hit, but a lot of our creative gods, Grant Morrison, for instance, really don't spend a lot of time playing with the old toys. They are going to come in and they're going to introduce new toys to make those old toys shiny and new again. And so we're very invested now in bringing in new stuff into these universes, for better or for worse.
Nice. So that is, that's a great segue as well, because I'm seeing relationships here between, you know, walking this line of playing the hits or, you know, stretching and expanding and doing cool stuff in properties, and how that relates to speaking to different audiences simultaneously while you're writing. So yeah. for instance, Kang was so interesting to me because it speaks to old fans who are familiar with Kang and who are excited to see like new ways of telling his story and sort of like placing him and having his, you know, versions of himself speak to other versions of himself. But it also speaks to new fans because it does sort of like serve as an intro to the character if you're unfamiliar, and to the wider arc, you know, of this world, right? So when you're writing, how do you stay attentive to all the different audiences you might be speaking to?
Well, with Kang, I think it's actually very, that one was in some ways is very simple because it comes from the core. With Kang, and with a lot of our work recently, we don't think about audience first. What we think about is what is personal to us about the book. What is the thing that has nothing to do with, and actually we do this on our screenplays, we do this on TV, we do this in podcasts, we do this in all the mediums that we work in, which is if you strip back all the genre, you strip back, so let's look at Kang, for instance. You strip back all the time travel and the spaceships and the ancient Egypt and the superheroes, you strip all of that back. What is the story about? It is a story about, effectively, it is a story about abuse and about abuse cycles and about cycles of violence and how our own cycles of violence feed our next cycles of violence and how it is hard to step out of cycles of violence established by our parents. And that's really ultimately what Kang is about. It is about desperately trying not to be your father and kind of turning into your father anyway, and not really knowing how the hell to get out of that cycle. And that is a story that is very personal and very direct to Colin and I, who have complicated relationships with our dads. So here we are with a story that comes from a very personal place and was something that we pitched to Marvel from a very personal place. They didn't come to us and say, pitch us a Kang story. We came to them and said, we have a Kang story. And it took us a year to get it greenlit, right? Because we wanted desperately to tell this thing.
And then part of the mandate there, though, obviously, is if you are going to be doing a Kang story, this needs to be, you need to satiate not only classic readers, but you also need to take advantage of the fact that Kang is going to be a big part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? You need to be aware of the fact that you need to be welcoming to new readers. So the question exactly is, how do we service both of those populations? And we realized we actually had it very easy, because our story is about a new Kang meeting the old Kang. So we have endemically to the storytelling the way to answer this question, because right. You know, one Kang knows everything that's been and the other Kang knows nothing. So that was a cheat. Like we stumbled into the way that the story organically wanted to solve that very question. But I also think, you know, it speaks back to your earlier question about the difference between our licensed work and our creator-owned work. That is a personal story that absolutely could have been a standalone creator-owned, you know, black box story about a young man meeting his father and being twisted by that, you know, that influence, by that corrupting influence. But instead we layered it into a superhero book because we found the perfect character to speak on it. And I think there's a really important piece of information for any young writer out there, which is that you are filled with good ideas. You do not have just one story to tell. So when you see an opportunity, take it. You know, take that great story and deploy it somewhere where other people can fall in love with it too. Because if you have a story that doesn't get read, do you have a story at all? Right? It needs to happen. So that one was particularly easier than others. Now, you want to talk about complications, we can look at Batman Beyond. or more importantly, Captain America, because with Batman Beyond, obviously there's something that the fans want, and we nuked it. They want Bruce Wayne. They want old Bruce Wayne talking to young Terry McGinnis, guiding him into the future. And our mandate there personally, internally, was nuke that. Let's make Terry grow up. Let's take the net away from him. Once again, a story about fathers and sons. But this time, let's snatch that father figure away from him. So rather than learning that he needs to, you know, grow past this, it's that he needs to embrace the idea and all of the things that his father was there to teach him, but then move forward and become his own man. Terry is the inverse of Nathaniel Richards in a lot of ways, because he takes that same kind of, you know, air quotes, cycle of violence, and then learns the best possible lessons from it and becomes the best possible version of who his father wanted him to be. The two books sit really interestingly side by side in a way that we really, really appreciate and love. And I think because we are true to the core of Batman Beyond, we respect the shit out of Terry and his journey. I am 100% positive that the fans are going to really be on board with where we are taking it. We're respectful to them. We are respectful to the things they love, and we are respectfully taking it out of back in the woodshed and putting it down like a dog.
I think that to me, that's the true, like, that to me uncovers the baseline of how there really isn't a distinction between corporate comics and creator owned. At the end of the day, at all times, all we're trying to do is tell a personal story that we think is exciting, that is going to use the toys available to tell the most exciting story for fans. And maybe that story is exciting, quote unquote, because it's literally exciting, because it's whiz, bang, punch, kick, superhero comics. Or maybe it's exciting because it disassembles something like Kang, where it disassembles something that hasn't really had its time to be disassembled, where you have a story that, like, it's not like we're coming in here and saying, oh, Kang is caught in cycles of violence and that's revelatory. No, that Kurt Busiek wrote about that in Avengers Forever. Like, that's been going on for 30 years. People have known that this is the core of Kang, but there's never been a time to sit there and look at it from a very personal character-oriented perspective. It's always been in the background of these big events. So here was a chance for us to come in and tell the story that we would. It just happens that when you bring in your foil, it's going to be Dr. Doom, or when you bring in your complication, it's going to be the Fantastic Four, or, you know, whatever it is. Like, those things come into the story because you're writing in a shared universe. But if you were writing in a creator-owned universe, you just make them up. And they would have different names and different faces, but they'd effectively have the same story value. It's just when you're doing it in comics, there's that recognition of, oh, look, it's him, which is sort of just how these, like, comic systems work. So it's fun, because I think it used to be that we had very different objectives in terms of our creator-owned and I think the more that we've, and maybe it's just that we haven't done creator-owned in a while, because truthfully we haven't done a creator-owned book since Zojicon, but because we've taken a big break from creator owned, we've had to figure out how to get that same objective and that same feel and hopefully that same kind of art out in the big two. And that's been a real challenge, and one that I think has been really fun.
Yeah, it's really cool to me that you can, obviously working with other people's IP creates certain kinds of constraints, but it's really neat that you are still able to bring like your own stable of themes and perspectives and interests and skills, you know, to them, so that it does sort of like, there's still room to sort of like assert yourself as an artist. You know, it's almost reminds me of like writing a sonnet, right? Like, you have a shape you have to fill, but you can fill it with whatever you like, you know?
that's a really good metaphor. And I think effectively that's the credit to the editors that we work with. That's because we work with editors who come to us because they want something from us, because they know what we're going to bring. When Dave Wilgos brought us onto Batman Beyond, he brought us on because he knew, like, that wasn't the thing where we were pitching it off. He called us and said, this is yours if you want it. Do you want it? You know, is there something to say here? And then we had to go back to our corners and figure out, okay, do we have something to say? And when we realized that the thing we had to say was Terry McGinnis year one without Bruce Wayne, what does that look like? And brought that back to DC. And we know that's a risk. They could easily look at that and say, well, no, part of the sandbox, part of the sonnet structure is Batman's in this, is Bruce Wayne's in this, so don't blow up the structure. But instead, they were able to look at it and be like, that's actually not the structure. That's just a part of the story that can the movie, the story can pass by, mm-hmm. you know, and we can move on to the next phase.
Very cool. So let's talk about your Captain America books, because you have two books about two different Captain Americas. And what was it like working? Because we have Sam and then we have Steve.
Yeah.
What was it like writing two different manifestations of the same character at the same time?
So we're not. The way that the books are structured is interesting, and I understand how it might be confusing at first, but Captain America is going to launch as a single book, Captain America number zero. That book is going to have Steve Rogers and Sam Wilson together, both as Captain America, both doing stuff. After that, the following month, so that comes out in April, that by the time this releases, I think that's the week that's on shelves. So you can get that. And that is by both of us and a writer named Tochi Unyabochi, who wrote for everybody who's listening to this, who wants to go to their public library and learn what's up with Tochi, Riot Baby, incredible book. He's won a bunch of literary awards. I think he just came out with a new book called Goliath, which is also incredible. Check out Tochi. He's brilliant. So Tochi is writing a book called Captain America, Symbol of Truth. That's going to start the next month. That stars Sam Wilson and is going to be the story of Sam Wilson picking up the mantle of Captain America and kind of being the quote unquote official Captain America for the Marvel Universe. He's going to be out there doing a big sort of conspiracy plot around the globe as he deals with the real world ramifications of being Captain America. I also think he's like teaming up with Deadpool. I mean, they're doing a bunch of like big Marvel Universe. He's, to some degree, playing the hits, but because the hits have never been played with Sam Wilson before, they are new and fresh and cool. And that's really like the objective of that book. Simultaneously, we're going to be writing Captain America, Sentinel of Liberty. Sentinel of Liberty is going to be taking place mostly in New York, in like lower Manhattan, with Steve Rogers moving home to the childhood home that he grew up in a little tenement apartment in lower Manhattan. And he is going to be re-engaging with life as a civilian and learning what it means to be Steve Rogers, like American citizen, while he simultaneously is uncovering a mystery at the core of the shield, a mystery that is basically the tip of a story iceberg that goes very deep into the last century of Marvel Universe history and involves a whole bunch of new villains and new allies, as well as old villains and old allies, who are all going to be coming together in a tapestry to kind of help us reevaluate the legacy of Captain America and figure out how to move it forward. So effectively, these two books are going to be simultaneous. They're going to be dealing with very different subject matter, and then they're going to be interlocking at certain places. So while we are involved in Symbol of Truth, insofar as we're helping figure out where Sam's going and we're incorporating Steve's journey into that, and simultaneously Tochi is involving Sam in our journey, we are actually not writing Sam. We, even in Captain America Zero, we wrote a few lines of dialogue for Sam, but by and large, the way that we approached that book was we wrote all the Steve stuff and he wrote all the Sam stuff, and we were like playing like jazz. We were working together to get that book to work in synchronicity and make sure that it works really well. But we're trying to kind of keep these books under their distinct tones and their distinct voices so that the audience really gets a fundamental difference between Steve and Sam Cap and can get both books and get the whole tapestry without feeling like they're effectively reading the same character. I think it's important that these two men and their two worlds be really distinct. And so that's where that structure is coming from. So we're not writing Symbol, we're just writing Sentinel. Tochi's writing Symbol, but he's not writing Sentinel. And then those two books interlock. As for how it is to write Steve, Colin, please. I just had to get the actual framework out of the way.
Oh, and once again, like, let's speak back to the danger or the concern when it comes with picking up a legacy of a character, because Batman Beyond has, you know, X number of fans, but Captain America is Captain Motherfrickin' America. So there's lots of people who have a lot of opinions about this character in a lot of, you know, different directions. So one of the things that we had to approach was his legacy, was diving deep into who he has been, because that's also something that we really wanted to look at. One of the keys that we have to remember about Steve Rogers is that he's a member of the Greatest Generation. He is someone who grew up in a very different time than us and has very different perspectives, but he is open-minded enough to learn and grow and adapt.
So what we've been trying to do is balance the direct sort of the traditional Captain America story, the sort of Americana values and the classic characters that people, you know, Steve, Bucky, Sharon, with the larger objective of ours, which is to tell something new and to tell something that, that fundamentally pushes Captain America's framework forward. So that's allowed us a really excellent opportunity to take things that everybody is aware of, things that people know, things that people have inherent ownership of. The most germane of these is the shield. Something that you see on t-shirts everywhere, it's on hats, people carry the shield everywhere. You see that shield, you know, it's like, it's one of those like few symbols where like the Steve Ross, or like the Batman symbol or the Spider-Man symbol, when you see it, you're like, oh, I know what that symbol stands for. You can look at the Superman symbol anywhere and be like, I know what that symbol stands for. Mm-hmm. The Captain America symbol for a long time has stood for America, or alternately has stood for Steve Rogers' conception of America, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. Our objective with the shield is to really interrogate over the course of our run what it means. And so what we're going to be doing is we're going to be taking Steve's understanding of it, and we're going to be challenging that. We are, they've said this a bit in the marketing, so I feel comfortable saying it. We're going to reveal that the shield is not what you think, that the shield is not his symbol, it's theirs. And who they are, what they mean by the symbol, why it is on Captain America's shield, and what he's supposed to do about it, those are core mysteries and story points that our book is going to be running out over the course of its first year. As we get through that, we're also going to be using that to walk longtime Captain America fans into these bigger changes that we're making, so that we're not coming in and running roughshod over a story that has been going for as long as comic books have. You know, like we're not, we know that we are the inheritors of one of the most storied legacies in comics, and we do. It might sound very, you know, pretentious, but like we take that really seriously. Like I don't look at the idea of like we're writing characters that were written by Jack Kirby and brush that off. You know, I really think that needs to be embraced. I think that needs to be understood as a mantle that you have to live up to. And part of living up to that mantle is living up to it the way that Jack Kirby did, which is create new stuff, take big swings, do, you know, when Arnim Zola first showed up in the early Captain America books in one of Jack's issues, he loudly proclaims himself Arnim Zola the bio fanatic before within 20 pages summoning a ancient eternal style robotic machine from under a swamp where it can destroy Captain America. I mean, like, they are not like, these are not books that are playing on like the subtle grounded nature of American imperialism. Like, these are books that are big mad science, madcap superhero stories. Mm-hmm. And so while I think for a long time, the last like over the decade, really the last like two decades of Captain America stories have been very focused, really almost since 9/11, have been very focused on what America means, what America is, what injustices America is either preventing or is participating in, and looking at how we deconstruct America using Captain America. We are now kind of trying to pivot the spotlight away from that. Not because we don't think that America is worth interrogating, but because in a lot of ways, that's what Sam's job is right now. Mm. What we need to be looking at is Steve Rogers and the Captain America legacy. Let's look at that, figure out the kind of injustices that has been involved in. Let's think about the kind of conspiracies that has been involved in. Figure out the way that Steve needs to not just stand for Steve, but needs to figure out a new conception of the shield, figure out a new way to do his business, figure out the next generation of Captain America stories. That's what we're trying to do. Whether or not that works, that's going to be the big question. We are taking big swings on a big character on our second Marvel Comics project. So, you know, this is a risk for us for sure, but it's one that I think is really exciting and one that is made maybe all the easier by the fact that Steve Rogers is one of our favorite characters and has been since we were kids. Mm-hmm. And so being able to stepping into the book with him at our back makes it all a little bit easier, because he is a character who speaks to you. Mm. You know, he is not a character who like lets you write stuff for him he wouldn't say. Like, he's a very opinionated character, and we don't work with a lot of those. Like, I feel like you can generally shape characters the way you want to shape them, but so far Steve's done what Steve would do, in my opinion. That's really where it's been. He's a very natural character to write.
That's awesome. Well, I'm very excited to see what you and Colin and Steve have done. Before we wrap up, do you just want to walk our listeners through what you have coming out and when, so that they know when they can pick these things up?
Yes, of course. So out now, you can pick up the first, so we'll start with the stuff that's wrapping up. So you can pick up the last few issues of The Harbinger from Valiant, which is our 8-issue story. If you've never picked up a Valiant Comics book before, completely fine. It is a intro book, so you should be able to step right in on it, but is effectively a refresh and a rebuild of one of their core characters, a character named Peter Stanchik, who's effectively somewhere between the X-Men and Spider-Man, but who is a very troubled young man and is going through a big kind of change up in our book. So you can check out The Harbinger. Issue 6 came out this month. Issue 7 will be out, or I guess issue 7 will be out in April. So issue 7 just came out, and then we'll be going on to issue 8. And that'll be the end of that run. So you can go ahead and check that out. That's with Robbie Rodriguez. The first collection is, I believe, already out. It's called Be Better. We have Batman Beyond out. Batman Beyond number 1, Neo Year number 1 is out in stores now. You can pick that up. That's with art by Max Dunbar and Sebastian Chang. A bunch of really beautiful covers. So really worth checking out there. And you can get in on the number 1. Captain America number 0 is out from Marvel Comics, art by Matai DeLuis, and with writing by the two of us, as well as Tochi Onyebuchi. We've also got we have coming up in a couple of months, Aquaman and the Flash Void Song, which is a 3-part Aquaman Flash team up. I talked a little bit in the earlier about how we work in different tones. This is our big Silver Age, light, fun, crazy romp of a book. We're not trying to get too deep. We're not trying to like deconstruct anything super hard. We're really just trying to engage in some good old fashioned, big budget storytelling. We think of it as like Independence Day for the DC universe. It's just this big, goofy blockbuster story, and we had a lot of fun with it. The art is by a guy named Vasco Georgiev. It is mostly a showcase for Vasco, who is a new artist who we just think is a genuine superstar in the making. So we're so excited for people to see what we're doing over there. That's another new character, by the way. The Void Song, which is the villain in that, is a whole alien race that Colin and I have created with the objective of bringing a new kind of flavor to science fiction at DC. So really excited about that. Fans of Green Lantern, check that out. I think you'd be really into that. Fans of like, you know, Roland Emmerich movies, you'll have a lot of fun. So those are all coming out from Marvel and DC and Valiant. In terms of the graphic novel side of things, we have Dark One out from Vault Comics. That is our collaboration with Brandon Sanderson, the fantasy author. Brandon created a world and then gave it to us and said, tell a story inside of it. And it was a brand new world that no stories had ever been told inside. So it was quite the honor. We wrote Dark One last year. That is out with art by Nathan Gooden, who was our collaborator on Zojicon. And we are now working on the sequel to that, which is very exciting. Again, alongside Brand. And Star Trek Year 5, all 4 volumes are now out. You can get our entire run on Star Trek, that Star Trek Year 5. There are 4 volumes. They're all some of the proudest work we've ever done with a whole room of like amazing writers, Brandon Easton and Jody Hauser and Jim McCann and Paul Cornell all came in to tell stories inside that room with us. It's the closest thing you're ever going to get to the last season of Star Trek, the original series. And we feel just incredibly honored to have been the showrunners on that. A dream come true for sure. So that's the rundown of what's out in stores right now. There's some great announcements coming up later this year. So we can't wait to share what we're doing in 2023 and beyond. But for now, that's what you can check out. Oh, and Kang the Conqueror, Only Myself Left to Conquer. You can find it. Trade paperback is out. That's a great, hey, do you want to just see if you like superhero comics? Do you want to see if you like what we do? Or are you just curious about Kang, having seen this character on the Loki television show? Boom. Kang the Conqueror is there for you. That's 5 issues, one and done, and you can get the whole story out that way. We're really proud of that book.
And yeah, hopefully you can find these books at your local library. Lord knows that we spent our entire youth basically camped out in the library. We are both massive library kids. So hopefully y'all are too. It's literally the most magical place on the planet. So hey, strap in and go anywhere you want.
You know, the best part of doing this podcast is just having people gush about libraries at us. Yeah, we love it. Like, we love to hear it. So thank you so much. It's amazing to me that like every project that you've worked on is like a bucket list project. Like, these are all such amazing properties and such amazing characters. And it's just like, you have so much exciting stuff that you've already done and you have so much exciting stuff coming up. And I'm, you know, just like, massive, massive congratulations to both of you. It's really amazing.
Thank you very much. It is a true delight and often very overwhelming. To have one dream come true is you know, a pretty amazing thing. To have several come true all at once is another. And we're we just feel very, very lucky to be supported by such a great industry and such a great fan base and such great friends. So thank you.
We haven't even talked about the we might have a we'll have a actual prose book in your YA section coming soon.
But it has not been announced yet. But we did, in fact, we spent our 2020 writing a prose book. It was our first chance at it, and yeah, it's publishing, I believe, next year.
Oh, amazing. Well, if you want to come back and talk about that or anything else, we would be absolutely happy to have you. This is a big comics library and it's a big YA library. So these are all like really good fits for us.
All right. Awesome. Well, we'll combo that out next time.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been Jen in conversation with Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly. And for now, we are going to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.